Hey, Samantha, where can they find us on the social medias?
I'm so glad you asked. They can find us on Facebook and Instagram at Reaper Tales Podcast and on TikTok at reaper.tales.podc. Just PODC.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you can email us at reapergals@reapertales.com. I'm always looking at it. So if you're one of the ones that emails me on a regular basis, you know that. I do respond almost in real time. Unless like
almost.
I'm on vacation. Or like I'm bed rotting, but that's a different thing. So email us at reapergals, G-A-L-S, at reapertales.com. Email me to tell me that I look pretty. Email me to tell me I'm doing a good job and to send us your show suggestions and anything else that you want us to cover or anything like that. So, yeah.
And please remember to like, rate, review, subscribe, all the things you lovely listeners know what to do anyway on any of the listening platforms that you use. As per usual, you get bonus points if you do it on platforms you don't listen to us on, but you give us a nice little review. And worded reviews will get special shout outs. So if you are so inclined to do so, please do us a favor. Makes it a little easier for people to find us. And if you don't Thanks. Want to be listed out, by the way, on the worded reviews, it's too bad. We're still going to give you a shout out.
Yeah. Yeah. Even if you say we smell like boogers or something like that. Okay. Thanks.
Rude.
Hello. I'm Montana.
And I'm Samantha.
And you're listening to
Reaper Tales. And today I thought Montana was going to forget what she was doing.
Am I going to do it? You're going to do it. You do it.
And today we have joint cases where, again, one of us did not follow the rules, but it was supposed to be scandalous cases. Montana followed the rules, go figure. And it was me that did not. But before we get into that, Montana, what are we drinking?
So glad you asked. I'm actually drinking a Truly, but the drink for today, if you want to try it, is called the Dirty Diaper.
It sounds delicious.
You know what? I had everything to make this, and I just didn't have time to make it before we recorded. But I'll probably make it when we get done. I'll send you guys a picture of it. But it is a half an ounce of... Also, be careful when you drink it. It's a half an ounce of vodka, a half an ounce of amaretto, half an ounce of Southern Comfort, half an ounce of melon liqueur, and half an ounce of raspberry liqueur, and half an ounce of orange juice. You're going to pour...
This is like a martini. It's like just straight up liquor.
Yeah. You're going to pour equal parts of all ingredients into a shaker filled with ice and shake it, then strain it into a glass, and there you go. It is guaranteed to make you black out.
Sounds like it.
Enjoy your dirty diaper.
Responsibly.
Responsibly.
Please.
Maybe you need to wear a diaper when you drink this.
You might.
You never know.
Just to be on the safe side. All right. And I don't have a drink, although I may get my husband to bring me one once I get
Do
through
it.
My part.
Do it. We'll see. It's my birthday weekend. You must drink.
Oh, that's right. It is your birthday weekend. And we need to drink too. Okay. Once he gets out of the shower, I'll ask him to go grab me one. Okay.
Okay. Tell him not to come out naked.
He knows that I'm recording. Also, he was like, I got to take a shower. Is it going to be too loud? So you may or may not hear the water in the background because it was a little louder than I expected. So we'll see.
I can't hear
Maybe
it.
Kelsey can edit it. We'll find out. But yes, he's aware we're recording. So wouldn't that be awkward? Let's hope he thinks about that. Anyway.
He comes out naked. Happy birthday to Samantha today, huh?
Oh, God. Anyway. It's my turn to go first, so I am going to tell you about Doc Bigham, who was a notorious Tuscaloosa outlaw.
Oh.
So notorious, not scandalous.
My favorite.
And Tuscaloosa, so we're back in Tuscaloosa. Born in Tuscaloosa County, Alabama in 1869, George Doc Bigham is known as the last person legally hung in Tuscaloosa County. But that's not the whole story, obviously, or this would be a really short episode, although my part's still going to be pretty short.
I'm not going to lie. When you said he was legally hung, my mind went to something else. And I was like, good for him. Didn't know that was a legal thing. Never mind.
Back on track now.
Yeah.
Doc Bigham was known to have the mind that a man had the right to make his own moonshine and run his own still, and it was not the place of lawmen to get in the way.
I agree with him.
Many said his entire life was, quote, one of lawlessness. Per the West Alabama Breeze, Doc was, quote, raised in a part of Tuscaloosa County where the making of booze was the calling of a good many men until prohibition sentiment grew to such an extent that wildcat stills were largely exterminated. He believed he had the right to grow his own corn and turn it into booze, and it was no man's business, end quote.
I agree with him. All solid points.
I wonder what his moonshine was actually like. I wonder that a lot. Like the way that people were making gin in bathtubs for a while. I wonder how it used to be because, I mean, I've had some moonshine in my day and it can be really rough. Like, it'll clean engines. But yeah. I wonder how it was back then, especially if it was the only thing they could get. I don't know how much they really cared about what it tasted like.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, also, it was all kind of sad anyway, so
true.
The only thing you could feel in your life was the burn of that alcohol going down your gullet.
That would probably do it. Before getting caught with the crime that ultimately cost him his life, he was serving a sentence of 25 years for killing a black man named Sonny Pruitt, which he always denied doing, but said he knew who was there and who the guilty party was, though he never revealed any names.
Why? Why didn't he reveal anybody's name?
Snitches get stitches. I don't know. He says that about several different things. And I feel like it could go either way because he worked with a lot of underhanded people. So, I mean, maybe the mob was involved. I don't know. He was like, I better not say anything, but it wasn't me.
He sounds fun. He sounds like a hoot. I bet he's fun.
I swear, reading this, it made me think of the Dukes of Hazzard. Like, this is I'm playing in my head when they're talking about some of this stuff because it just makes me think of it anyway. Prior to that, he was also arrested and charged with the assassination. And why they used assassination, it's interesting because this person, as far as I know, was not in any kind of political, like, place of power. So you only usually only hear assassination with that. Otherwise, it's just murder. But this one was an assassination of his uncle, E. Cooper, who was shot in an ambush. When asked about that crime, Doc said, quote, 13 of us have been in jail for that killing and none of us have ever been convicted.
Then why were you in jail?
So he served time, but he was not convicted. I don't know.
Oh,
I guess it fell through. I don't know.
The laws seemed really loose back then. So
to put it mildly. Yeah. Lastly, he was also questioned regarding the burning of 12 to 15 houses in the E.B. Terce neighborhood, which he again denied, but assured those asking that he knew who did it. This guy is in the know.
Honey, stop. You got to save a little mystery.
He took it a step further. He stuck to, you know, you've got those old men that sit on the porch all day, every day, and they know everything that's going on around the neighborhood because they're documenting it and calculating it all in their head. He took it a step further and actually got involved in a couple of things, but refused to tell anybody. But he knew it all.
Now, when somebody asks me something and I don't know the answer to it, I'm just going to go, I don't know. Maybe you should ask Doc. He knows everything.
They'll be like, Doc who?
Don't worry about it.
Well, sir, he knows, but now he's probably not going to tell you. He's just going to assure you he definitely knows. While serving the 25-year sentence, he managed to escape and came back to Tuscaloosa County. In the woods near Foster's Ferry, Doc had been living with his 18 or 19-year-old son, depending on what place you get it from. And his son's name was Dude, D-U-D-E, located on the bank of the Warrior River. Sheriff Palmer and his crew attempted to arrest him, but Doc and Dude both opened fire and the officers returned fire, resulting in both Doc and Dude being shot. But unfortunately, it was Dude who ended up bleeding to death when one of the bullets ruptured an artery in his leg. Aww. Doc was then taken up the river by a boat, where he begged the officers to shoot him dead because he could not bear to live with the knowledge of his son's death and what had caused it.
Oh, poor Doc.
Poor Dude. Like 18 or 19 years old. That's really young. They, of course, denied the request, bringing him into the Williams and Falk Infirmary for treatment, where they thought he had a chance for a full recovery. Doc's younger son, George, alias George Scales, I don't know why, but it was given, so I'm giving it to you, okay. too, was captured shortly after and taken to a Tuscaloosa County jail, as officers believed he had been working with Doc by reporting the officers' movements whenever they had a lead. So he was Daisy Duke, basically.
Oh.
Maybe distracting them. They believed this because it seemed every time they would get close to his capture, somehow that slippery devil would get away. So obviously the only reason that was happening is because he had help. I don't know why they thought this kid knew what they were doing and could tell Doc. Like, what was his in? It was not explained. It's not like he worked for the police department. So, like, how is he telling Doc stuff that Doc didn't already know?
Maybe he was seeing somebody on the police force.
That would be ultra scandalous. That would bring the scandalous part into it because women weren't working on the force at the time. you might have solved it.
Hey.
I put in here, I was like, I don't know. I mean, how subtle was your manhunt? Let's be honest. Like, were you in guns a-blazing and were you like telling everybody, oh, we know where he is? Also, it sounds like he was living there. So it's not like he was hiding. He was near his home. So I don't know. I don't think that they were being real discreet. I don't think it was hard for him to know what they were doing.
All I imagine is just a bunch of police officers that look like who's the cartoon cowboy guy who's constantly yelling and he pulls out his pistols. And who is that?
Kelsey's gonna look it up.
You gotta look it up.
You're not talking about Elmer Fudd, are you?
I think it's Elmer Fudd. There's a bunch of Elmer Fudds. And
Elmer Fudd is the one that tries to kill
with Bugs Bunny.
Yeah, but it's the same. It's Looney Tunes, or it's Looney Tunes, right?
It's Looney Tunes.
Looney Tunes cowboy.
Is it? It's not the chicken, is it?
It's Yosemite Sam, Looney Tunes. He's the one.
Yosemite Sam.
With the big old mustache.
Yeah, rootin', tootin', gosh darn. That's all I imagine. It's just a bunch of those out in the woods. And I'm like, no wonder.
So we're
going
to have to just put a picture if we can get away with it.
Can you make the video just a picture of him up here?
Put that in, put that for one of our cameras every so often on some of the videos. In any case, Doc was then taken back to the prison at Wetumpka, but somehow managed to escape yet again. According to one source I found, at this point he felt greatly persecuted and vowed he would not be captured alive again.
Oh.
Just 2 months later, per tavm.omeka.net, quote, on August 15th, 1918, Sheriff Palmer M. Watts, deputies Werner Robertson and Nick Hamner, and special revenue officers, why revenue officers are getting involved, I have no idea. They had a very different job set than they do now, I feel. But they were getting involved.
It's unreported revenue. His name.
Yeah, but are they going to bust this person? I feel like that's not typically their job. Like getting involved in like finding the person. I feel like that's a little bit.
They got to get their bag too,
I guess. And special revenue officers J.H. Smith and J.H. Draper had raided two stills in northern Tuscaloosa County and had one more to go. As the sheriff made his way down a ravine to a third still, a shot rang out and the sheriff pitched forward on his face, instantly dead.
Ooh.
Which is why this guy's the last one legally hung. I mean, that was like, You're not going to get past that. A deputy fired a shot at the shooter, identified as Doc Bigham. Police officers Curtis Thompson and Bertram Osment located Doc Bigham about 12 miles below Tuscaloosa, just off Foster's Ferry Road, and engaged him and his two sons. And it said two sons, but other things said that his son had died earlier, and I think he had, so it kind of goes back and forth. Maybe he didn't die and they just thought he did. I don't know.
Or he died during this encounter.
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, it's kind of mixed. This was back in like the late or the early 1900s, so I don't think they did a great job reporting things back then.
Well, especially if Yosemite Sam's the one that's filing out the reports.
You know? True. That's very true. In this gun battle, though, nobody was injured. Bingham, his wife, and two sons were living in a tent on an old place of I.A. Robertson's. When Thompson and Osment neared the tent, they were fired upon and got separated. Thompson thought Osment had been killed and sent word back to Tuscaloosa. Sheriff Palmer, a number of deputies and policemen, as well as Coroner Rogers and several doctors, hurried to the scene. So this is, I guess, how this all got brought about. That's why all of these people showed up. Osment was soon located unharmed, as was Thompson. Judge H.B. Foster notified Governor O'Neill, and the reward for the capture of Bingham was raised from $50 to $150. So
they tripled it.
Apparently, the officers had managed to hit Bingham twice, once in the arm and the second in the knee. He was captured 3 days later by a hunting party led by bloodhounds. He, quote, was unarmed except for a switch that he used to keep the dogs off. I forgot about that part. I like how they use the word switch, so basically a stick, for those of you that don't live in the south of the United States. He had attempted a surgical operation on his knee with his pocket knife.
Ow. Ew.
And that was from There's Grave Silence Today in Inga County's Death Cell by Bob Kyle. The article that I just said, There's Grave Silence Today in the County's Death Cell by Bob Kyle, I'll actually read an excerpt of that at the end because he did such a good job writing and it was really interesting. Doc's trial took place September 17th, 1918, on the charge of capital murder of Sheriff Palmer. 3 days later, the jury began deliberations and delivered their verdict just 5 hours later. Doc was sentenced to be hanged. Notably, Doc never denied the charges. Judge H.B. Foster agreed to the jury's recommendation and passed the sentence upon him, setting the date of execution for November 1st, 1918. There was an appeal made, but the Supreme Court upheld the ruling. Leading up to the date of the execution, Bingham refused to talk about the case, saying, quote, every time he got to talking about it, he got mad. So that's fair. He already felt persecuted before any of this happened, so it's not super surprising. And that he didn't like to get into that frame of mind, quote, any more than he could help, end quote.
It sounds sure. like he's always in that frame of mind. What is he talking about?
He doesn't want to talk, but he says that every time. So, I don't know.
Okay, but
it kind of does speak a little bit to his mindset, because obviously persecution, like, he really felt like everybody was out to get him. This is the gist of what I'm getting this whole time.
Me too.
Oddly, he did agree to pose for a picture for the newspaper, but only because at some point he had promised to do so, and he wasn't going to break his promise, apparently.
He sounds like a Leo. I'm not going to lie. When was he born?
I didn't have a date. I couldn't find his actual date of birth. I only found it the year. And we'll his tombstone only has the year. So, yeah, you're probably right on the nose. Mm-hmm. If I had to guess.
Yeah. That's Leo energy if I've ever heard any.
2 minutes past 11 a.m. on June 27, 1919, Doc Bingham was the last man legally hanged in Tuscaloosa County. Bingham had tied his own noose, wanting to make sure it was perfectly done to ensure his neck would break, which I feel like that could have legal ramifications if he did it incorrectly, but, you know, whatever. It was a different time.
It's also like, it's such a glaring, like, the solidity of the image of Yosemite Sam, just that right there. You are too stupid to tie a noose correctly. Let me do it myself.
You know? I want to make sure I actually die in the correct way.
Oh, man.
Which also fair. Because it was done incorrectly a lot, where people's neck didn't break and then they had to hang there until they suffocated to death. So that's very fair. He had also requested to be, quote, hanged by an honest man, end quote. So they had B.V. Hughes, who was the brother of the sheriff, pull the lever that released the trap door below Bigham. The execution that day was said to have been, quote, one of the most perfect hangings that has ever taken place in Tuscaloosa County, end quote. He did the rope exactly right. It did snap his neck. He did instantly die. So, like, fair. At least, apparently he knew how to tie a good noose, I guess.
Yeah.
That's something he could do well.
But they also have to, I can't remember where I learned this. Actually, I think it might have been, it was like a true crime book. Probably. A true crime Looney Tunes. It was, God, and now I can't think of the book's name. It was it's a true crime book. It's like one of the top true crime books out there. It was about these two men who broke into this family's house, killed everybody, robbed them, and then they went like on the lam. But when they eventually get like arrested and hung, it goes over like the details of a hanging and how there's like a lot of thought and math that goes into hanging a person. And it's not like one size fits all. It's like all of that.
The rope has to be the correct length. You have to drop a certain length as well in order for it to be enough force to actually break your neck, which is why it's done incorrectly, or it was done incorrectly a lot, because they didn't take account for all of that. Especially like if somebody was tall, it made it a whole lot harder for them to do it correctly. And their weight.
Yeah. Kelsey, I know you're looking for that book.
In Cold Blood. Oh, that's a novel.
I think it is in Cold Blood.
Oh.
I'm pretty sure.
In Cold Blood. Truman Capote. That's a novel, though. But I guess I didn't know if it was nonfiction or fiction.
Yeah, this is it. Yep, they were executed by hanging on April 14th, 1965, to ruin it for everybody. Well, if you haven't read it by now, it was actually published in the 60s. So that one's really on you. Anyway, sorry.
I don't think you're ruining it for anybody.
Yeah. Sorry to derail us.
No, you're good. So there was quite the crowd there that day, as per usual, with many asking to see Bigham before the execution and every single request being denied. 3 minutes after the hanging, members of the crowd donated money to go towards burying him according to his request in Macedonia Cemetery on the Crab Road, which I thought was interesting. In the last hour, he had also requested that the sheriff not allow the crowd to cut off pieces of the rope used to hang him to keep as souvenirs. Gross?
That's a weird request.
But apparently this is something people did. They would cut off pieces of the rope that was used to hang people and then keep it.
Mm-mm. I don't like that.
And I was like, I was really surprised that this is something that apparently people did. But I guess I shouldn't be too surprised, because I did go to that museum in Las Vegas and I saw that room full of serial killer stuff that obviously people collected and he did and paid for. But still, it's just like, I didn't like that either. That felt gross. I didn't want to be in that room because it feels so wrong just to do that. Like, I don't even want to be around stuff like that. But
murderabilia is like one of the grossest things, and I will never understand why it's around. Like, why people want to have a piece of that. Like, you want a piece of something that was a part of a family or somebody's worst day.
Mm-hmm.
The worst day they'll ever have. The most tragic day. What the fuck is wrong with you? Like, good Lord.
Or a piece of something that was the person who caused that. That's even worse.
Yeah, it is. Because you're like, you're praising those people who are doing horrific, you know, terrible things, unforgivable things. And just, wow. Maybe go see a therapist. That's all I'm saying.
That's a good suggestion. I think that's an excellent suggestion.
Thanks.
Weirdly enough, I will say, because I'm kind of impressed with all of these requests that he made. They were all reasonable requests, in my opinion. And all of them were granted. So they did make sure that nobody in the crowd got any piece of the rope that he was hung with. So
it kind of sounds like he was like a town favorite, or like, I don't know, because people...
He was notorious, so people definitely knew about him.
Yeah, they collected money for his burial, and it seemed like he was liked. He just, you know, he fucked up.
A lot.
Like, yeah, I don't know. Poor guy, though.
So, I mentioned I was going to read a portion of that article by Bob Kyle, who wrote about the location that he was kept in years and years and years afterwards. And the article was just so interesting that I wanted to just read straight from it. Just the portion where he's talking about the location afterwards. Okay. So this is all from that article. There's grave silence today in the county's death cell. Quote, the old death cell, gallows and trapdoor in Tuscaloosa County Jail is now silent as a grave. You can thump on the iron bars and it bounces all around, a hollow sound that comes back and rings in your ears. The old iron ring attached to the ceiling overhead where the hangman's noose was tied is still like the pendulum of an ancient clock that has gone to sleep forever. But somehow, a man doesn't feel alone in that place, not when he's heard old-timers talk about the last public hanging that took place on a hot, muggy day on June 27, 1919. On that day, almost all of the grown-ups in Tuscaloosa County turned their mules into the pasture and came to town. The crowd surrounded the jail. Guards were employed to hold back the curious while a desperate man inside calmly went about tying his own hangman's knot. The same gallows and trapdoor stand intact today, but the hinges are rusted. Very few people have had occasion to view the famous old death cell on the second floor of the jail. Many, perhaps, have walked by it without knowing what it was. They even use the same cell now to house juvenile offenders to isolate them from older inmates. But right over the head of the jail keeper, as he sits at his desk today, is the trap door where Doc Bingham dropped to his death at 2 minutes past 11 a.m. that day 38 years ago. It was the last legal hanging in Tuscaloosa County, but it won't be soon forgotten. They say Doc was an extremely smart man for his educational opportunities. Affable, genial, and witty, but a man you couldn't push around. He had friends that he believed in, but had a persecution complex and figured that a man had a right to operate his own boo still once he begged his captors to kill him after they'd shot and fatally wounded his boy. So you weren't wrong, it sounds like, because it does sound like he was well-liked, even though I feel like he was well-liked from a distance.
Yeah.
He had people that probably, he had a few people that knew him, but also maintained their distance because they also knew he was trouble.
Yeah,
it's kind of what
that's
I,
a Leo.
The gist I got.
Huh?
Oh, yeah, that's it's a Leo. A Leo. You're not wrong. That, my friends, is, I told you to keep it short and sweet. That's the story of Doc Bingham, the last man legally hanged in Tuscaloosa County.
Well, here's the Doc. Well, good job. That was interesting. Entertaining. He would be my best friend, not going to lie.
I feel like you and I would get in so much trouble, the two of you.
Hell yeah. I already do. Well, good job. So now we're on to mine, I guess. Mine is actually a scandal, but, well, it turned out not to be what I originally thought it was going to be. So this is where the drink pairing is going to come in. So anyway.
Yeah, I'm interested to find out how this all ties together, because that was such a weird, but okay, I'm here for it. We'll figure it out.
Well, it's interesting because, like, every once in a while I'll get on Reddit and I'll look for, like, there's a few different ways I find cases that I want to cover, and one of the big ones is I get on Reddit and I look for, you know, like, interesting unsolved or, like, just whatever, you know, true crime around my area. And I actually found a pretty good subreddit on there that was talking about different cases and things like that that I had never heard of. And as I was looking through these comments, I found this one, and it was named The Diaper Party. And I was like,
I would not want to be known for that, but okay.
Well, it's not a party like you're thinking of, like a political party. It's a party, and we'll get into it a little bit. So what I thought would end up being like a funny story about a police chief caught with his diaper down actually ended up being something more nefarious than that. I could have actually made a multi-parter about this, but I'm not going to do it because the town that we're going to be talking about is called Woodfin. And it's problematic, to say the least, to this day, still has issues going on with corruption and allegedly in the police department. So this is one of many issues that Woodfin has.
Okay.
So I'm just going to focus on, you know, obviously Woodfin as a whole-ish, but Pete Bradley is our main person today. And Pete grew up in a well-to-do Biltmore Forest family. Pete always wanted to be a cop, and as a kid, he dressed up in a police uniform and directed bicycle traffic in his Asheville neighborhood, which is kind of cute.
Bicycle traffic?
Yeah. whatever gets the job done.
Yeah, sure.
In 1996, he kicked his career off with the North Carolina DMV as an enforcement officer. During his time at the DMV, Pete was allegedly passed over for a promotion. This was the straw that broke the camel's back for Pete. During his time at the DMV, Pete had witnessed several instances of political corruption. The loss of the promotion spurred Pete into contacting the FBI in early 2000. The FBI took down all of Pete's allegations and an investigation quietly began. The investigation ended up encompassing 13 Western North Carolina counties and led to a federal grand jury probe. During this time, Pete had actually taken a job as Woodfin's police chief. And before I go on, I do want to talk a little bit about Woodfin so you kind of get a feel for what this town is. Woodfin is a town in Buncombe County, North Carolina. The population around this time was 3,162 people as of the 2000 census. It is part of the Asheville Metropolitan Statistical Area. And the town's history is closely tied to manufacturing. Much of the remaining early housing stock is characteristic of the early 20th century mill villages. Many of the neighborhoods within the community bear names tied to the industry, such as Martell Village and Company Bottom. The decline of American industry in the 70s and 80s brought a decline to the economy of Woodfin. The loss of many manufacturing jobs led to a decline in population and property values. Starting in the 1990s, however, the town has experienced new residential growth, due primarily to an influx of new residents to Western North Carolina. Woodfin's economy today is a mix of large and small-scale manufacturing combined with a variety of residential and commercial districts. So basically, it's a small town. And even this past census in 2020, there were only like 9,000 residents. So it's still not a lot. It's not like a big town. And because it's a small town, it does have a small town mindset. And one important aspect of this is that the town is located north of Asheville. So it's right above Asheville, and it is the main town to go through if you're coming from the north into Asheville. And so I got on Reddit again and looked up the town, and there are residents that live in Woodfin, and they're not too happy with it because it is a known place for speed traps. So as people are going through this town to get into Asheville, you're probably going to get a ticket.
Yeah, we've got one of those around here that anybody local would recognize. All you have to do is say, if you're driving through Kimberly, and like, yep, watch out for those speed traps.
Yep.
And it's on a main road. So I feel like small cities like that, that have access to a main road, like a main highway, they do have a tendency to do that.
Yeah. And before I continue, I do want to give kind of a little trigger warning on some of the content that we're going to cover. I should have done this at the top, but better late than ever. There is going to be talk of domestic violence. There is brief mention of murder, you know, corruption. There's also some bigoted things and against certain sexual lifestyles, we'll put it. So just be forewarned as we continue. Pete would only enjoy his new elevated status in the town for 3 months. In 1999, Pete actually left his job as a DMV enforcement officer and opened a law enforcement supply business. The following year, Pete said he tried and failed to get his DMV job back. And this was right before he took the chief position, the police chief position. The reason for this is a bit complicated, but according to Pete's allegations filed with the SBI, in order to get a job back, job within the DMV as well as other governmental agencies, you were forced to make donations to specific political parties. Quote, "They wanted more money to come back. That's when I went to the SBI," he said. He also said he was asked to give Democratic candidates $5,000 to get his job back. Quote, "That's when I blew up and said, I'm sick of all the crap." That's also when he went to federal and state investigators.
All fair.
Yeah. Yeah. Just before he did, he got what he described as an anonymous blackmail letter. It alluded to parties he attended with men who wore diapers and snapped pictures of one another. This is the diaper party that we're talking about. And I'm not going to...
I have questions, but anybody. I have a feeling you're not going to be able to answer them. But I feel like my questions are similar to most people's.
Yeah. I know that this is a thing, and like, I'm not kink shaming you. If everybody's of consenting age, but you know, do you, boo, I don't care. But I truly thought it was going to be an opportunity to make fun of a cop, honestly. But turns out that's kind of not what we're doing here. Quote, "No threats here," the letter said, "but I would suggest leaving well enough alone to preserve your privacy, or people may need to know the deal. The repercussions could be bad for any career, yours no and others.
But let me give
let
you
it
the
go,
threat.
Man.
Like the
quote, yeah, right.
It's literally the definition of a threat. Like, I'm not trying to threaten you, but also there will be consequences if you do X.
That is like whenever I say not to be a bitch. You know, not to be a bitch, and then I am then the bitch.
That's your precursor. I'm about to do that. I'm actually about to, but just letting you know, that's not the reason why. It's just the result.
Yeah. Bradley later acknowledged participating in the consensual gatherings, which he called his personal business. He's correct.
Yep. Has nothing to do with it.
Right. On his attorney's advice, he gave SBI investigators the letter only after being assured it would remain confidential.
Which obviously didn't happen.
Bingo. What gave it away?
The fact that we're talking about it right now.
Pete's allegations covered a variety of corruptions. While working at the DMV, he alleges that he was pressured by supervisors to make contributions to the then Democratic governor, Jim Hunt, among other candidates. Pete claimed to have given Hunt's campaign more than $2,000 in 1996, quote, "to get my job application process" when he was first applying to the DMV. Records show he and his wife gave Hunt, former Lieutenant Governor Dennis Wicker, Senate Leader Mark Basnight, and others $6,600 over the next 2 years. Bradley said he gave the money through supervisors and gave more in unreported cash donations.
Let's pause for just a second, too. Working at the DMV ain't going to make you a millionaire. So it's not like he can really afford to donate a whole lot of money, if I had to guess. So you're wanting this job and you're like, okay, but you have to donate more money than you already have. And he's already donated thousands of dollars. Like, I can't afford to do that. How are they supposed to?
Right.
And also, by the way, in case there was any question, that is completely illegal.
Yes.
That's not something that's allowed to happen in the United States. But okay.
Proceed. Oh, but it gets so much worse. One of the main accusations centered around bribery. If you aren't familiar with weigh stations, they are the stations through each state that 18-wheelers roll over scales to weigh the trucks. There's a variety of reasons you need to ensure a truck is under a certain weight. Most of them have to do with safety and the infrastructure of the place through that county. My dad actually bitches about this a lot. He's a truck driver, and they'll get him all the time because his truck is over. But it's a very common practice to have overweight trucks because the more you can haul in that one trip, the more money you're going to make. Because it's not, a lot of the times it's not based on mileage, it's based on like tonnage or weight. So if they can get by with doing that, that, you know, they will. Pete alleged that bribery and extortion by DMV officers at weigh stations in Buncombe and Henderson counties in western North Carolina was prevalent. District Attorney Charles Hibbs of neighboring Haywood County told the Asheville Citizen's Times, whenever this was written, that he tipped SBI investigators off about what he thought was ticket fixing by DMV officers in 1999. So this is a district attorney that also tipped off the SBI. And Pete and this district attorney weren't the only ones who had similar complaints. David Brookshire, a former enforcement officer with the DMV who also worked with Pete, claimed a supervisor asked him to ask a paving contractor for $500 towards a golf outing for DMV and Transportation Department officials. Quote, "The solicitation of such cash contributions from paving and other contractors for such purposes was standard practice within the enforcement section of the DMV," Brookshire said in the complaint. He also said it was, quote, "standard practice," unquote, for enforcement officials to accept football tickets and other gifts from the contractors. David Brookshire's supervisor, Ramsey, denied the allegations in a motion to dismiss the suit. And just like Pete, David was retaliated against for cooperating with the investigation. David Brookshire was fired from the DMV after working there for 21 years.
What was the justification? What did they say it was for?
They said, so I don't actually put this in my notes, but in his court filing against Woodfin and David Brookshire's court filing against Woodfin, it states that he was wrongfully fired, blah, 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 blah. And then the DMV comes back and says, no, the reason that you were fired was because you accepted bribes from the paving company to void out their citations and tickets, which he then denies. But is kind of like talked about a lot that this was a standard practice to void out that specific paving company's overweight citations.
So to get away with doing something that would be more along the lines of like a whistleblower, basically, we're going to accuse you of doing the thing that you were reporting as being the practice that was the problem.
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
Allegedly, based on the information that we have. So this current probe involves claims that echo previous criticisms of the DMV. The most publicized was in 1997. A former enforcement officer named Algie Toomer testified before a state house committee that then DMV Commissioner Alexander Killens pressured him into donating to Hunt's 1996 campaign. The panel was investigating a $100,000 settlement Toomer received on leaving DMV. That's another person. DMV officials denied having coerced a donation. A Hunt spokesman said the governor had ordered his campaign not to accept money from rank and file state employees. But in 1997, a coalition of groups, including the conservative John Locke Foundation and the more liberal NC Alliance for Democracy, asked the state auditor to do a comprehensive review of political patronage at the Transportation Department, which includes the DMV. One of the groups, Democracy South, found that DOT employees and their families had given more than $100,000 to Hunt's 1996 campaign. Quote, what emerges is a pattern of widespread abuse within DOT that involves political money linked to jobs, promotions, board appointments, highway contracts, and the location of roads, unquote. And that was Auditor Ralph Campbell. The Citizens Times said a confidential 1986, so a decade earlier, memo by a DMV official, quote, alleges officers at way stations in Buncombe and Henderson County accept payoffs and gifts, campaign for political favorites while on the job, and failed to cite grossly overweight trucks owned by influential construction and paving companies. Weights are monitored for tax purposes and to comply with safety guidelines. So they're pushing who they want in the government, and then they're allowing these contract companies to get away with unlawful weighted trucks and things like that because they can benefit from getting the contracts from the city, who then they can feed into the pockets of the politicians who they're keeping in office. So it's,
you know who this sounds like, right? Or you know what this sounds like, right?
What?
The whole global financial crisis where the SEC got busted for, you know, not doing their job and looking the other way with certain companies because they were getting paid good money, and Standard & Poor's ratings of the bonds and that sort of thing. Yeah. Sounds markedly similar.
Yeah, doesn't it?
We all know how that went, by the way.
Oh, yeah. It worked out really well for all of us, especially the ones that were, you know, just coming out of high school and needed a job and things like that. Worked out well. It wasn't me. I swear, I'm not bitter.
At all.
Gary Bradshaw, a former DMV enforcement officer from Kinston, said he was forced out of his job in 1993 after telling state investigators that certain trucking companies were allowed to elude regulations and making other allegations of misconduct. Gary said nothing came of this complaint back then, and the recent, like, rumors spurred him to, again, follow up and be like, hey, this isn't just like a Buncombe County, Henderson County sort of thing. Kinston's all the way on the east side of the state. So it's kind of a widespread thing that's happening in North Carolina. Among all of these allegations, other allegations popped up about Mayor Homer Honeycutt at the time. A Woodfin patrolman said he taped Honeycutt bragging about fixing tickets. Quote, I fixed more tickets than you probably write, Honeycutt boasted on the tape obtained by the Citizens Times. Quote, you write them, I fix them, unquote. So he's just admitting to it, like, outright. So in a lawsuit filed by David Brookshire, it acknowledges that APAC Harrison Division Paving Company set up a tent at David's wedding. But David defends himself by claiming, quote, plaintiff did not solicit this as a gratuity and was not aware of it prior to being done. When he asked about it, a representative of the company told him to accept it as a wedding gift. Further, as alleged, on occasion, they were also offered football tickets from APAC representatives. However, this was standard practice within the division and District 8. Plaintiff did solicit a cash contribution for $500 from the paving contractor, and this was for that golf outing. However, it was not APAC Harris, as alleged in the dismissal notice, and the solicitation was done at the direct request of Captain Ramsey to support the golf outing. The solicitation of such cash contributions from paving and other contractors for such purposes was standard practice within the enforcement section of the DMV at this time. So the paving company, this paving company specifically, gets regular citations and tickets, but they all get like voided and dismissed. And there's like countless cases of this occurring and multiple people saying that it occurs. And like I said previously, in turn, if the politicians scratch that company's back, that company will scratch those politicians' back and make sure that they are in a place of power, allegedly. Allegedly. Ron Dayton, the only member of the Woodfin Board of Aldermen who didn't vote to fire Bradley, told Express that he has received two threatening phone calls from anonymous callers who told him he needed to, quote, support Honeycutt or get out of town, unquote. Dayton also said that someone had cut the phone line to his house shortly after he first publicly expressed support for the police chief, talking about his support of Pete Bradley. Dayton has also been the target of an anonymous pamphleter. Woodfin residents and shoppers at a nearby supermarket have had flyers placed on their vehicles that read, quote, citizen alert, protect yourself from Alderman Ron Dayton. Queer lover, unquote. And that's what I meant by making sure you understood the small town.
Wow, you like to think we're past that stuff, but apparently not.
No, apparently not. That's so stupid. Why use that as like a jumping off point? Because I'm going to tell you right now, Pete Davis is a lot of things. And they could have used those other things to talk about him. But that the one thing that should never matter to anybody else, you're going to use? Okay. No. Bigotry at its best. Pete filed a suit in response to his firing in 2002 against the town of Woodfin. The Woodfin Board of Aldermen and then Mayor Homer Honeycutt as well. The lawsuit asserted that Woodfin officials had violated Bradley's right to free speech and had made libelous statements about him. At the time, Express reported that 2 months before he was fired, Bradley had secretly recorded Honeycutt telling Bradley that if he didn't resign, something bad might happen or come out. The lawsuit also named Gary Ramsey, Bradley's supervisor at the DMV, as a defendant. According to Bradley, Ramsey was a key figure in the DMV corruption scandal. Ramsey maintained his innocence throughout the investigation, and no criminal charges were ever brought against him. Nonetheless, the DMV removed him from his position in 2002. Bradley's lawsuit asserted that Ramsey was behind the release of the blackmail letter, which I can believe because if that recording is correct, that something bad will come out. Hello, hi. On April 15th, U.S. District Judge Lacey Thornburg issued a 33-page ruling that paved the way for a trial, denying numerous requests by the Woodfin defendants that he throw out the case for lack of merit. In his ruling, Thornburg wrote, quote, "The court finds the plaintiff has put forth sufficient evidence of a retaliatory action by the defendant Ramsey. The court further finds the plaintiff has demonstrated a genuine issue of material fact as to whether the blackmail letter was written by the defendant Ramsey," unquote. Now, however, there will be no trial and no exploration of the blackmail letter's origin or how it came to be leaked to the media, and the racketeering allegations against Ramsey will remain unproved charges. This is unless somebody can violate the gag order that was placed after they settled. So they settled.
Oh, now we're going to be quiet about it.
Mm-hmm. So they settled on it, didn't have to, you know, go to court, and then they were placed on a gag order to never talk about what actually happened. Shortly before the start of the Board of Aldermen's May 17th meeting, Pete Bradley walked into the Woodfin Town Hall carrying a briefcase and a boombox. When asked why he was there, Bradley replied, quote, "I'm here to close the case." During the public comment portion of the meeting, Bradley stood at the microphone and thanked Woodfin residents for their support. He then asked Mayor Jerry Vehan for permission to play a song that, in Bradley's words, Jesus, quote, "pretty much says the whole story. It's an American song. It speaks about the freedom of speech and First Amendment. this great country of ours and the men who fought to give us our rights. It says it all, unquote. The mayor consented. Bradley turned and, after some nervous fumbling, pushed the play button, and Lee Greenwood's God Bless the USA cracked over the speaker.
I knew that's where that was going.
I was like, I had to put that in there because I was like, the fucking nerve of some people. Like, what are you doing, my guy? Bradley then thanked the assembled officials and sat amid a wave of warm applause. So I'm a little torn on all of this. If you only look at what I've given you about the scandal so far, it seems pretty cut and dry, and that there was like widespread corruption going on, and that Pete seems to be kind of a victim of a smear campaign that, I mean, it drug out his private life. It ruined his career. You know, it was cut down the middle in the town. He was either hated by people or defended by people. And it was on a topic that nobody should really know about. But, you know, it might not be as simple as that. Because this wouldn't be the last time Pete Bradley would show up in the news. A few months later, on October 4th of 2005, Patricia Bradley was found dead of an apparent suicide. I couldn't find a lot on the investigation of her death, but the coroner report called her death a suicide, and the cause given was, quote, depression and domestic discord, unquote. But in 2007, Pete Bradley was convicted of domestic violence against his wife, Patsy Bradley. The domestic violence event took place a month before Patsy was found dead. He did attempt to appeal the conviction, but the appeal was rejected. And he was sentenced to 30 days in jail. Yeah. Prosecutors said Bradley struck his wife in the head during the early morning hours of August 31st, 2005, leaving a lump the size of a golf ball. Officers said they found her scared and crying in her car at a neighbor's house. A prosecutor told jurors at Bradley's assault trial that Bradley told officers investigating the death, quote, "I guess she won't be testifying against me," unquote. Family members testified Patsy Bradley was terrified of her husband. Hospital workers said she told them her husband struck her with a flashlight. But, you know, again, the people who are investigating her death, though, and are coming up with some of these claims that Patsy said, are the same ones that Pete sued. You know?
But also, two things don't have to necessarily be mutually exclusive. Both things can be true. And
yeah,
they might be telling the truth and it just happens to be super convenient for them.
Yep. I agree. I mean, I think two things can be true at the same time. Corruption can be going on and you can get mad because you didn't get what you thought you deserved and you blew the whistle. And then there were unjustified repercussions for that, but you can also be a domestic violence person. Mm-hmm. So
you can also be an asshole.
Yeah.
You can be right in one situation and completely and totally wrong in the next. That is definitely
possible.
Yeah, all
I'm saying is you can wear a diaper in a room full of other men in diapers and, you know, still assault your wife.
It's possible. You shouldn't, but it's possible to do.
I mean, wear your diaper if you want in a room full of other men in diapers, but don't assault your wife. That's what we're saying. Live your best life. Anyways, so later Pete was actually arrested again on possession of a firearm. And since he was he had a felony conviction for DV, he was arrested for that, but then the charges were dropped. And that's all I can find about it. So yeah, that was my scandal. Woodfin. Pete Bradley.
It's a lot. Small towns, man. They got some mess going on. Let me just tell you.
And all of this is alleged. Everything's alleged based on the information provided to us.
Exactly. All the time. That's basically any case that we cover. It's only as good as the information that we're able to dig up and what's provided. Obviously, we can't speak to things that are not public knowledge. If I knew anything that was not public knowledge, I would not be talking about it on the podcast. Let's put it that way.
Truth.
I'm not about that life.
No, I'm not.
I don't look good in orange. I stay away from that color.
Yeah. I mean, he kind of sounds like a turd.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, this is one of those cases where, like, it doesn't feel great at the end of the day. Like, it still feels gross on both sides of the equation. And that's one of the unfortunate times where it's like the things of these two things can still be true. It's kind of also unfortunate because you really only want the underdog to be the one that's right in a situation like this. It really sucks when it's quite possibly allegedly an asshole. But yeah, unfortunately, that is the case. That's life. That's the life we live. So
100%.
Good job.
Thanks.
I'm very conflicted and quite outraged, but also not surprised, unfortunately.
Well, what I can say is this will not be our last trip or our only trip to Woodfin, because even as of last week, the police department was still in the news for things that they were doing.
They're like Wells Fargo. They just can't stay out.
You silly gooses. Stop doing that. We're going to give you a silly goose citation.
Well, yeah, look forward to updates. Great.
Hey, you're welcome.
So good job, though. It was a gross case, but also very interesting. I'll say that.
Girlfriend, if you think this was bad, wait until I do my standalone. Hey-oh, that one's going to be bad.
That's for next time.
Hey, yeah, it is. Anyways, well, good job to us. Thanks, Kelsey. Everybody, a round of applause for Kelsey. Yay.
And happy birthday, Montana.
Happy birthday, me. Everybody raise a drink to me. It doesn't have to be alcoholic, but
it's not water.
Yes, happy birthday. Aunt Tana, as what Trip calls you.
That was so cute. Thank you for that. Cheers. And until next time, we love you. We mean it.
Okay, bye.
The Reaper will come.